Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, February 3rd, 2014. As we speak, the gulag at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba is still open. And over 160 prisoners are being held there. This is a song about Guantanamo by an artist we've recently discovered here at PeterBCollins.com. His name is John Dist, and it's one of the tracks on his new Red Flag CD. Our interview with John Dist is released to subscribers today, including many samples of the tunes on this powerful and politically very strong CD, Red Flag. And it turns out that John was influenced by listening to podcasts with me, Sibel Edmonds, many other people, including Andrew Gavin Marshall over at BoilingFrogsPost.com. And I want to thank him for taking our work and converting it into musical expression. I like the songs. I think he's a talented songwriter and a pretty damn good guitarist. The production is good on this CD. And in this excerpt from our interview, John Dist talks about his own struggles when he learned about what the United States was doing at Guantanamo in our names.
But the black site, you know, I was thinking about it. I think my empathy that I feel for people locked up in such situations comes from a book that I read in the 90s called In the Belly of the Beast by Jack Abbott.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about being so deprived of beauty that even a colored handkerchief would bring tears to his eyes. And, you know, when the torture memos, when they first started talking about torture memos in the Bush administration, I couldn't believe it. Like, I was so shocked. I emailed everybody I knew, and I said, look at this, torture memos. What are we getting, you know, how can we be doing this in America? And nobody cared, you know. And to me, it was just so offensive. And the thing was, why do we do it? Because we know it doesn't work. And I think the key thing I wanted to get across in that song is that, you know, even Stalin didn't torture anymore because he wasn't getting good intelligence. So there has to be a reason why we're doing it. And I believe the reason why we're doing it is to get people to say what we want them to say, to build cases for war or whatever else we want to do that would otherwise be not popular.
I invite you to listen to the full interview with John Dist. It's available for subscribers today at PeterBCollins.com. And we'll mention the subscriber deal here in just a second, but I want to note that the heavy metal band, or maybe they call themselves industrial rock, Skinny Puppy, objects to the use of their dark music being played over at Guantanamo as part of the torture routines of the prisoners there. And so Skinny Puppy has decided to sue the United States government and to charge them for royalties for using their music in a torture setting. Now, I know a little bit about music licensing, and there are different applications. You know, if somebody performs a song live in a nightclub, you pay one royalty. If it's a song that gets played on the radio, it's a different royalty. I don't know if there is a torture clause for abuse of people's music. But you may recall, this goes all the way back to Poppy Bush's invasion of Panama back in, 1990? And they blasted heavy metal tunes and other kind of music at Manuel Noriega in his hideout as a way to flush him out of his secret location. And this, of course, went on at Abu Ghraib, where music was used to torture prisoners. It has been a feature of the American interrogation routines for many years now. And I congratulate Skinny Puppy for at least demanding that the government pay to use their music in a way that tortures people. I hope it's not torture for you to listen to my podcasts, and I invite you to support our work. And if you're a new annual subscriber like Linda Clark, she just signed up from Washington State, well, I will send you a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee, lovingly grown and handpicked by Russ Archibald and his buddies on the Big Island of Hawaii. Plus, this new CD by John Dist, and I highly recommend it. I've been playing it in my car, driving around, and here at the studio, and there are a lot of important political messages. He's a damn good guitarist, and I think the songs are very strong, too. So check out our podcast, and if you're not a subscriber, become a new annual subscriber, and you'll get a John Dist CD as your bonus gift for signing up here at peterbcollins.com. Now, there are other forms of incarceration that I would like to focus on today, including the immigration detention centers operated by the U.S. government. Many of the detention centers themselves are private prisons operated by corporations, and the combination of being immigration prisons and privately managed creates the potential and what has been actually proven to occur, a lot of injustice and mistreatment of the prisoners in these immigration detention centers. Well, we learned from Florida today that there are five men from Sri Lanka who paid $50,000, $55,000 each, to be smuggled into the United States, and they got caught. They traveled from their home in Sri Lanka, and they went through many stops to get to the United States. They came from Haiti, before that Cuba, and before that they flew to, let's back up here. They started in Sri Lanka, were flown to Dubai, then to Moscow, then to Cuba, then to Haiti, where they took a boat ride and attempted to enter the United States. That was on December 5th, 2010. In short order, they were picked up, and they have been held without charge ever since. Now, at one point, an FBI agent who the Sri Lankan men said came to visit them and tried to pressure them every day to testify against their smugglers, well, he finally got his way. So these men, after years of being trapped in this U.S. detention facility in Florida, decided to go to court, and they thought they had a deal with the FBI. In fact, an FBI agent named Anthony Montgomery is reported to have promised them that he would bring their families to the United States and set them free. So they went into court as witnesses for the FBI and testified against their smuggler. He, of course, even in the middle of a federal courtroom, threatened them, saying that when I come out, you'll see what I can do. You people are idiots. And then his family in Sri Lanka contacted the families of the individuals who had hoped to be smuggled into the United States, and their families were extorted for additional money. But the ringleader here, a guy known as Mohan, who's a Canadian resident, pleaded guilty to knowingly encouraging and inducing immigrants to enter the U.S. illegally. He was sentenced to 5 years in prison. Now, since then, the Sri Lankan detainees have never heard from the FBI again. And now, they are at risk of immediate deportation. And one of them said, "I'm going crazy in this prison in the United States, but if they send me back to Sri Lanka, I will go mad." And that, I think, gives you an idea of the really bad choices available to people in that situation. And the article goes on to say that immigration judges can be extremely arbitrary, and the judge presiding over this case appears to fit that category, and they have no rights of appeal. And once they are ordered to be deported, that's it. And so we have, right in our midst, right here in the freedom-loving United States of America, a draconian system that treats non-citizens like animals. And as we hear the Republicans grapple over trying to come up with some politically acceptable immigration proposals that don't get the amnesty opponents on the far loony right all exercised, I haven't heard anybody, even liberal Democrats, talk about the plight of people who are trapped in our immigration jails. And here's another form of police state mentality that has been codified into law? I want to commend Ryan Shapiro. He's published a first-person account at truthout.org, and I will link to it for you today in the show file at peterbcollins.com. Shapiro is described as a doctoral candidate in history, anthropology, and science at MIT. And he goes on to tell us that he was once a protester against the grisly process of raising ducks in captivity to produce what's called foie gras. That, of course, is taking their livers and turning it into what is considered a delicacy, pâté. And in the last few years, the production of foie gras in California has been banned. That was the product of a ballot initiative that passed back in 2004. Ryan Shapiro was an activist in support of reining in or eliminating this kind of treatment of ducks in production here in California. So he went to a duck farm, and they rescued ducks. They released them from a factory farm. They made a short documentary film to educate the public. And he ended up being sentenced for trespassing and was required to perform community service. And he says this is a reasonable and acceptable price to pay for his civil disobedience. But back in 2004, the FBI designated animal rights and environmental activists as the leading domestic terror threats in the U.S. Now, it's total bullshit. As you know, right-wing extremists and people who commit gun crimes are much more of a risk than animal rights activists. And in 2006, under heavy lobbying from pharmaceutical, animal ag, and other industries, Congress passed the misguided Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, the AETA. And I want to tell you a quick story. About a year after that passed, I was interviewing Maxine Waters, the relentless liberal congresswoman from Los Angeles. And toward the end of the interview, I said, Maxine, I looked and you voted for this really bad legislation, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And she didn't pause a minute. She didn't get defensive. She didn't make any excuses. And this is so rare. It's the only time I've had a member of Congress act this way. And she said, Peter, you know what? I got that one wrong. I really regret my vote, and I wish I could take it back. Well, Ryan Shapiro points out that the AETA, when it's linked with the new state-level ag-gag bills, these are ALEC bills, that's right, from ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, model bills that have been passed around from one state legislature to another, that make it a crime to shoot an undercover video on a working farm. So that if you see animals being abused, or even maybe human farm workers being abused, it is a crime to shoot that video and release it to the public. And Shapiro writes, as intended, ag gag laws in the federal AETA have cast a chill over the animal rights community. Many advocates, including myself, have begun to censor themselves and refrain from speech that is protected by the First Amendment, or from peaceful civil disobedience in the tradition of some of America's greatest voices. These fears are well grounded. That's why I am in court today as a plaintiff in a lawsuit filed by the Center for Constitutional Rights. We seek to have the federal AETA struck down as an unconstitutional infringement on free speech. I fully support that. And I don't support some of the efforts of animal rights activists. I think sometimes they go too far. But to characterize trespassing or vandalism or similar crimes that have been occasionally attributed to animal rights activists, to call those terrorism, that is offensive in the most obvious way. Now to the update on the surveillance state here in the United States of America. There is a new biography of Edward Snowden called The Snowden Files, written by British reporter Luke Harding. And a first installment was published in the Guardian newspaper over the weekend. And it is very interesting, and it raises some of the contradictory aspects of Ed Snowden's biography. I mean, how did a guy who didn't even graduate from high school wind up with these high-level security clearances working for CIA and then NSA? And I encourage you to read it because I think that we all deserve to know as much as possible about Ed Snowden. I also want to note that my friend and colleague, Sibel Edmonds, has published a couple of recent commentaries at BoilingFrogsPost.com that make me uncomfortable. I think that Sibel has done an important job in raising important questions about the anomalies of Ed Snowden's whistleblowing, about Glenn Greenwald, about the pace of release of the documents that Snowden grabbed from the NSA, Greenwald's relationship with Pierre Omidyar, the billionaire who helped build eBay and PayPal, and he has a pretty sketchy history, particularly when it comes to progressive values and free media expression. So there are valid questions to be raised about the whole sequence of events since Ed Snowden surfaced. But Sibel, in my view, takes it a step or two too far and reaches conclusions in which she refers to Snowden and Greenwald as charlatans. And frankly, I don't think that there's enough evidence available so far to sustain those characterizations. And at this point, I'm not willing to embrace those. There's a hacker group in Germany that's filed a lawsuit against the government of Chancellor Angela Merkel, accusing the government and members the chancellor and members of her government of violating German law by helping intelligence agencies in the United States and Britain to spy on Germans. The International League for Human Rights, along with a group called the Chaos Computer Club, a leading German hacker organization, say in their complaint that Merkel's government and German intelligence agencies violated the personal privacy of German citizens through illegal and prohibited covert intelligence activities, along with aiding and abetting such activities by tolerating and cooperating with the NSA and its British equivalent, the GCHQ. And the German government responded that any citizen has a right to file such a complaint, but they didn't comment any further. And Ed Snowden, in a recent interview with a German reporter and the public TV station NDR, said that the relationship between Germany's Foreign Intelligence Service, known by its initials BND, and the NSA are, as Snowden says, intimate. Quote, "They not only share information, the reporting of results from intelligence, but they actually share the tools and the infrastructure." So that's the latest we've heard from Snowden. Meanwhile, from Silicon Valley tech giants today, a release of data on the number of accounts which the tech companies were required to turn over information to the government, usually NSA, sometimes FBI, in a recent period of time. Now, this was a negotiated settlement to a lawsuit that was brought against the NSA, and it has been cited by President Obama in his January 17 speech as one of his so-called reforms. So, what did we learn? Well, tens of thousands of accounts associated with Microsoft, Google, Facebook, Yahoo, and Skype were turned over. Well, their data was turned over to U.S. government authorities every 6 months as a result of secret court orders. So the terms of the deal still prevent the companies from itemizing the collection of this information. It's aggregated into large chunks of information that makes it generally meaningless. And, for example, Microsoft received fewer than 1,000 orders from the FISA court for communications content during the period of January to June of last year. Over at Microsoft, they were mostly requests for metadata related to Skype, the video conferencing service. Yahoo disclosed that it gave the government content from between 30 to 31,000 accounts over the first 6 months of last year, and fewer than 1,000 customer accounts that were subject to FISA court orders for metadata. Facebook said that during the first half of last year, it turned over content data from about 6,000 customers, a rise of about 1,000 from the preceding six-month period. The data from Google shows a significant growth in Internet content collection from the NSA. In the first 6 months of 2009, the company gave data from about 3,000 customer accounts. And by the middle of last year, it was between 12 and 13,000 accounts. Here's a comment from Kevin Bankston at the Open Technology Institute, quote, "Lumping all of the different types of surveillance orders together into one number, then adding obscurity on top of obscurity by requiring that number to be reported in ranges of 1,000 is not enough to educate the American public or reassure the international community that NSA is using its surveillance authorities reasonably." And over at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Nate Cardozo says, "The information was a first good step, a good first step, but he added that large questions remain." And he said the national security letters, for example, had all been lumped together, and it was impossible to see what legal framework had been used to compel the companies to hand over information. So this is consistent with what I said Obama did on January 17th. Cosmetic changes that don't give the American people or anyone else information that is really very usable or significant. Last Friday, I attended a seminar in the afternoon, so I recorded my news and comment in the morning, but didn't get to post it until later in the day. And in it, and I'm not claiming any great powers as an oracle, I predicted that the State Department's latest environmental report on Keystone XL was going to be released late on Friday afternoon heading into Super Bowl weekend. And son of a bitch, I was right. And I want to commend the folks over at the Smog Blog, Steve Horn and his colleagues, because they were right on top of it and noted the Friday trash dump of this document, a carefully stage-managed release of the report. And, of course, the corporate media seized on the report and simply said that it didn't identify any significant environmental problems from construction of the northern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline. But as Horn points out, and I'll link to his article for you, the group that conducted this review is a dues-paying member. It's called ERM, by the way. ERM is a dues-paying member of the American Petroleum Institute, which predicted last week that the report was going to be published very, very soon and that it would not offer any detrimental findings related to TransCanada's desire to continue and complete construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. Also on Friday, we learned that David Wildstein, who was a top appointee of New Jersey Governor Chris Christie at the Port Authority, which is a joint agency operated by New Jersey and New York. Wildstein, through his lawyer, reported in Friday's New York Times, has said that there is evidence that Chris Christie knew about the bridge closure, either before or during the closure itself. Christie has repeatedly said he learned about it afterward and blamed underlings who he has fired and called stupid, and those stupid people are ready to bite his big ass. And it seems like that is underway. Today is the day that subpoenas were supposed to be responded to in the investigation by the New Jersey State Legislature. And so Chris Christie is fighting an uphill battle to hold on to his job as governor of New Jersey. And that was another late afternoon report on Friday heading into Super Bowl weekend. Now, I did break down and watch the last quarter of the game and was relieved to find out that it was a blowout and that Seattle just walked away with the Super Bowl championship. I'm not invested in the NFL, and if your team won or lost, well, you know what to do, I guess. But I did learn after the fact that at the post-game news conference, a young man who had no press credentials and not even a ticket to the game managed to bust into the news conference. He is 30-year-old Matthew Mills. He grabbed the microphone before one of the NFL players was about to speak, and in 9 seconds, he said, "Investigate 9/11. 9/11 was perpetrated by people within our own government." Then he walked away, receded into the crowd. He was picked up by security. He was arrested for trespassing. But what I learned that is even more fascinating is that the coach of the victorious Seattle Seahawks, Pete Carroll, is a truther like me. I don't really follow these football coaches and know even less about their off-field activities and interests. But according to a report by Deadspin last June, Pete Carroll supposedly questioned retired General Peter Corelli, who at the time had just concluded his term as vice chief of staff at the Army. And Carroll wanted to know whether the attack on the Pentagon had really happened. Well, Mr. Carroll, so do I. And as you know, I don't believe the official narrative. I haven't been able to approve any alternate theory to prove or approve, but I still don't believe the official story. And it's kind of comforting that an NFL coach thinks outside the box and is willing to confront the public ridicule that is visited on truthers like me or this guy Mike Mills. So, Mike, nice going. And finally today, the news broke just before the big game started that Philip Seymour Hoffman had died in New York City at the age of 46. Hoffman, who had spent 23 years sober, had recently returned to rehab and, by all accounts, was battling an addiction to heroin. And it's a little bit grisly because when he was found dead, he reportedly had a needle in his arm. And others, I think, will be much more eloquent than I can. I'm not a film critic. I'm not an expert on movies. But like many Americans, I was struck by virtually every role that Hoffman took on. And I'd like to single out one, because he played a character who was a substitute for L. Ron Hubbard in the film called The Master. They couldn't call him Hubbard, and they had to obscure a lot of it because the lawyers for Scientology either did sue or repeatedly threatened to sue. And so the filmmakers had to make those adjustments. But I thought his portrayal of Hubbard at various stages of Hubbard's life was really incredible. And many people remember him for his portrayal back in 2005 of Truman Capote. Likewise, a character of many dimensions. And I think Hoffman was amazing in his ability to bring those characters to life on the big screen. Can't think of much more to say. Happy trails, Philip Seymour Hoffman. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.